This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show dedicated to the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today.
In order to become Zaha or Norman or Jack, or you have to be identified, and therefore you are a product too.
One of the world's most celebrated architects talks coffee pots and the plight of designers. We check in with David Chipperfield and ask how the right kind of design can help to combat our obsession with consumerism. Plus,
I'm nervous that it becomes another fashion industry where there's the pressure to always have new quality, new products, new style, you know, every fall season, and everyone's following everyone.
Shanghai-based designer Linda Neri sounds a cautionary note on the pitfalls of a design calendar that pushes for new products every season. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24 with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined in studio now by Daphne Karnesis, this show's producer. And Daphne, you've had an eventful few weeks, haven't you? You've been at the world's largest, or definitely the world's most important trade show in Milan, enjoying life on the piazza, having lots of big, heavy pastry meals, I imagine. Did you get up to anything else? Where have you been? What have you been doing?
Yeah, it really was pasta every day, Josh. There's only so much someone can eat. And I was there for a full week, as you said, so quite a while. It was really great. Weather started off nice. Towards the end of the week, unfortunately, let us down a bit. And I think Milan is one of those cities where it feels Southern European when it's sunny and when the weather is nice. But when it starts to rain, you can really tell that it's a northern Italian city.
And far from being on a jolly, you were there for Salone del Mobile, the Milan Furniture Fair, a real who's who of the design industry. There was a light shone on the world of lighting. There was a lot of young talent to be seen. You've got a few trends that you've spotted from the Milan Furniture Fair. Could you start us off with one of them?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things that I picked up on was office furniture and workplace design, and really how, I guess, the boundaries between office and home furniture are actually starting to blur. So one of the interviews that I did was with the Japanese designer Naoto Fukasawa of Maruni. Actually, you'll definitely recognize him because here at Monocle, the Monocle office and the cafe, we have a lot of his beautiful wooden furniture.
The Hiroshima collection.
Yes.
Spotter's guide.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things he was saying is that, you know, wooden furniture used to be mainly used in the home, but now this sort of handcrafted type of chair and furniture design is something that we find in the work environment too. It's not a different industry anymore. Interesting also was our interview with Benjamin Pardo of Knoll. You'll remember that the founder of Knoll, Florence Knoll, passed away earlier this year. We did a feature on her. And he was talking about, you know, what makes a good-looking office and what makes a good-looking workplace and how that's really being affected by mobility and where people work. And it was interesting that he was saying not just the different ways in which people work and locations in which people work outside the office, but even inside the office, you know, thinking about whether people work at their desks or standing up or in a meeting room and how companies should be adapting to that as well. He was also saying that he's really looking into smart furniture and how things like, you know, apps regulating colour and lighting and how furniture has to catch up with the developments in technology as well.
Sounds absolutely infernal, offices changing colour and being controlled by apps, but there you go. I want to move on a little bit. I suppose it's a little bit related to the workplace in some sense. I want to talk about pressure. I want to talk about designers being under pressure specifically. Now, we do have an interview later on with David Chipperfield, and he touches on this point. But I think it's a really interesting sort of existential issue for the world of design as more and more trade fairs demand more and more attention, and there are more and more things that need designing. Did you sense that there was a greater pressure on the designer to be distinctive, to be clever, and really to have a lot of ideas compared to what they may have needed to have 10 or 15 years ago?
Yeah, especially that last point that you're saying about quantity, about constantly having a new launch. And in fact, a lot of people said that maybe where the design industry is heading is to start mimicking the fashion industry a little bit, and this sort of notion of seasonality, that you need more launches every season. And Linda Neri, who is a designer at the Shanghai-based group that you mentioned earlier, Neri and Hu, who we'll hear from a bit more later, actually highlighted this point, and he said that whenever his studio thinks about new products that they're going to launch, he always thinks, you know, is this really what the world needs? Does the world need, you know, another bathtub or something? Is what we're offering useful? And I think what feeds into that also is the notion of functionality. And I think designers are becoming a bit more self-aware and thinking, is this something that's actually functional and not just something that will look good for a little while and then people will get tired of or kind of realize that there's not much need for it in their homes or in their offices. There was a really interesting interview I did with a young couple, Jilly Kuchik and Rana Mitai. They're a Tel Aviv-based duo who have created a chair this year that they debuted for Magis, the Italian furniture brand. And it's a stackable chair. And so they sort of started their process in the inverse. So they thought, you know, how can this be functional? How can it be useful? They designed it out of magnesium, which is, I think, 30% less weight than aluminum. So it's lighter. Theoretically, you can endlessly stack it. It's also got
explodes when you put water on it, doesn't it? Magnesium. And maybe that's my high school chemistry experiments.
Maybe it's at a certain temperature, okay. But I'm sure they've taken that into account.
I hope they have. Yeah, exactly.
But exactly, you know, they said that there's a opening at the back of the chair for draining water. So obviously, the aesthetics of it came into play, but they said that they sort of started by thinking about whether this is functional.
Well, that's good. I'm a bit of a cynic, as listeners to the show may be aware, and I always found it very strange when I used to go to Salone that you would have all these people gathered round a chair made out of cod scales or out of algae or something, and you're like, half these people have flown around the world to see this monstrosity. And, you know, when we talk about sustainability, it needs to go hand in hand, I suppose, with some realism about the way that the world works, which kind of brings me on to my next point. We were promised that the office of the future would be different, the workplace of the future would be different, and all of our lives would be different because of technology. But I get a sense when I see people coming back from Salone that a lot of the deals that are done, whether that's the ordering of contract furniture or the making of acquaintances of architects and designers and important manufacturers, that these things need to happen in person, and that there is still a sense that you can't do this online, it can't be digitally mediated, and that Milan is still a meeting point. We're going to throw ahead to a few interviews. Daphne, what have you got coming up for us on the show?
So one of the really interesting interviews is with the British designer David Chipperfield. He has an office in Milan that Tyler Brulé, our editor-in-chief, and our founding editor Andrew Tuck visited while they were there at the beginning of the week, at the beginning of Salone. And it was a really interesting discussion. The reason that he was part of Salone this year is he redesigned the classic, the Mocha coffee pot, the Alessi pot. And it's really interesting to hear him talk about the intersection sort of between product design and architecture, which is essentially his remit.
We're not really product designers or furniture designers. So the only time I jump into this pool is when I'm somehow motivated to do it. And it's pointless trying to have any to enter in the way that, you know, our friends Constantine or Jasper, or, you know, I mean, they're professionals and it's their life, you know. So the only way I get involved is, in a way, as an architect, not as a designer. Therefore, those things tend to be rather personal. The first things I did with Alessi were, I just couldn't find bowls. You know, I came back from Japan and I just wanted to eat, you know. You just couldn't find a range of things. Everything was like typical tableware. So why don't we design that? You know, you sort of design things slightly different. I mean, this fascinated me because it's connected to architecture, in my opinion, that it's the role of innovation and that how innovation has become part of branding. And in a way, how can you have confidence to be not seduced into the idea of innovating for the sake of innovating, which is partly to do with stimulating a market? So I felt a sort of cultural responsibility on this more than a commercial responsibility, because I'm not a commercial designer. If I was a commercial designer, maybe I would have another set of anxieties. You know, every young architect, every project you get is your opportunity to break through. So there's so much pressure on you as a young architect to make something that identifies you and identifies you against somebody else. So it's quite difficult to do something which is anonymous. You know, I mean, I saw some comments. My daughter sent me some comments from Dazeen or something like that, you know, and people say, why did he bother? I mean, it's, you know, it's, couldn't he come up with a better idea? And it doesn't hurt me because it doesn't worry me, you know, whereas, so I think it's quite interesting sometimes to be able to stand back from, and I think especially now, because I think that in a way design has become part of leveraging consumerism. I mean, in a way, let's be clear about it, that's what, you know, design after the war was about applying, and you know, if you read Bauhaus texts, you know, the application of design to technology and to industry to produce the highest quality objects for the most people, you read this and think, oh God, how easy. I mean, what a nice manifesto is that. Whereas now, it's about making a coffee pot more expensive than it, you know, or a table light or a lamp or, you know. So design is becoming a leveraging tool for consumerism. And I think I don't think I'm saying anything secret about this. I think we all have to rethink how much we consume. And therefore, I think the whole status of making objects and even architecture is something we have to rethink. And I think we're in that position in architecture. We do a lot of working on historic buildings, and therefore in those things we can feel reasonably comfortable that we have some sort of responsibility. But of course, we're all complicit. You know, none of us can claim to be not complicit in something which is also, makes the world go round. I mean, the idea that we're all going to sit at home and carve, you know, our furniture is obviously nonsense. But I do think gradually we have to start rethinking the idea of consumption. And therefore, I think designers have to be part of that. And I think the danger is, as designers, well, certainly as architects, we are, in a way, a little bit at each other's throats. Because in order to become Zaha or Norman or Jack, or you have to be identified, and therefore you are a product too. And I think going forward, I think that we have to rethink this a little bit.
It's become this world where, as you say, everything needs to immediately be recognized by who made it, and it brands a city, and it's how much money did it bring in. Do you think that we need to take a step back from that? And in a way, many of the buildings that you've shown us the models for today come back to a level of kind of respect for what exists already, as well as a kind of more modest world of intervention.
I mean, these are big, generalized and very superficial statements about, you know, quality of life. But I do think that we have to start understanding quality of life is not being dependent on consumption. The planet's telling us that. Everything's telling us that. And I think that all societal unrest at the moment, I mean, something as mundane as Brexit, this is a protest by people who feel left behind, that society is, you know, those of us that have something and those of us that don't, and the gap between that is becoming too substantial. We have a foundation in Galicia where I'm working a lot, working with the government and trying to protect the physical environment, the natural environment, and in a way, quality of life. And someone said to me recently, because I would say it's one of the poor areas, but I would say there's a high quality of life, and it's not quality of life based on consumption. When I asked someone recently, I said, but can I really say there's a high quality of life here? And this guy must be 70 or something, and said, yes, I think you can. And I said, but why? And he said, David, we don't expect too much. And I thought this was like a sort of haiku, you know, it was like a sort of piece of profound philosophy, that you can be happier if you're not. Now, of course, they have a natural environment, which, you know, Galicia's, you know, you get up in the morning and, you know, the birds are singing and there's a, you know, maybe raining, but that's very different than getting up in Sunderland, some horrible street, of course. But I do think it tells us that the quality of life, and I think this is where architecture can play a bigger role, which is looking after not just museums and shopping streets, but schools and hospitals and housing.
If we stay in Spain and on the coast of Galicia, is there something different in the social mechanics of a Galicia versus Cornwall, for those who might not be familiar with what's happening in Spain, would you say? And, of course, through the lens of Brexit as well.
I would say, first of all, we don't have much tourism in Galicia. And I would say there's a very interesting thing happening at the moment, which is an anxiety about tourism. The mayor of Santiago said recently, he said, oh, we have a tourist problem. And I thought, oh my God, he's another one going to say we need more tourists. And he said, no, we have too much tourism. And I think Santiago de Compostela, it's relatively unspoilt from that point of view. I mean, there is a lot of, and they're nice tourists in a way, I want to say. But I would say we do a lot of work in restoring it. And I was on a prize giving recently, and it's very interesting how, I would say 15 years ago, prizes for restoration, heritage, were tended to be connected to tourism. there's a sort of critique now. Are we just protecting heritage in order for it to become part of branding, become part of tourism, become part of city identity? And again, in Spain, I had a very good conversation with the foreign minister, of all people, talking about tangible heritage and non-tangible heritage, and how Spain is becoming more interested in how do you protect non-tangible, not just bricks and mortar, but a way of life, music, traditional structures, things like this.
Is there a threshold then for when projects get near to your office that you're, okay, that just isn't what I'm interested in us pitching for, working on? Because we've shown us projects today which are a new university extension in Padua, a fascinating project in Smart Square. They have a permanence and a legacy about them which is tangible, that you can see how these are going to leave something behind. So when people come knocking at your door, are you beginning to narrow down the things that can come through to you as potential projects?
I would love to say that we're very moralistic about these things, but we're as complicit as any, you know, if someone comes with a commercial project. I mean, sometimes we need these things to keep us going. People tend not to come to us for a large skyscraper somewhere, I guess. And it's not because we necessarily don't want to do it, because I think to maintain a commercial office, as we do, we can't afford to be as moralistic as I'm sounding. And I also don't want to be that moralistic, because I don't think you can all of a sudden say that we're not all part of this. It's unrealistic to, otherwise I wouldn't be flying around the world. Or, I mean, on an individual basis, it's very difficult to know what one can do. We tend to attract a certain type of project, I suspect. And I think in Italy, there are two types of project. One, which is to do with, let's say old buildings, because they have an extreme amount of them, and they value them. And then the other is to do with the market and investors. And I guess because of our own history, Noyes Museum and many others now, we are seen to be people that can deal with these complicated condition. So it sort of suits us as well. We tend to gravitate that way, and people tend to gravitate towards it that way. Having said that, you know, if someone came along with a nice new airport somewhere, I think we'd be very happy to do it, and then sort of scratch our heads and think, how does this fit into our moral description?
That was architect David Chipperfield speaking to Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé and editor Andrew Tuck in Milan last week. A little earlier, we were speaking about the architect and designer Lyndon Neri, who travelled to Milan from Shanghai, where Neri and Hu, his office, is based. He sat down with Monocle's executive producer, Tom Edwards, in Milan to give us an insider's take on the fair and why designers are under constant pressure to innovate.
Some of these brands we've designed for 3-4 years. For instance, Agape, the bathtub that we designed for them that was featured last year, we worked on it for 3.5 years. And they thought just because we were practicing in China, things should be fast. And so a lot of them are finding out, a lot of Italian brands are finding out that we're actually quite slow. It's not so much slow, but I think we just want to make sure between Rosanna and myself, we're constantly making sure that what we're doing, and we're questioning, is this really what the world needs? Another bathtub? So our bathtub was especially small and especially tall. So it's an Asian typology, what you see in Japan and China. But also it's addressing the issue of space and limited space, right? And so these are things that we work on in the studio as a team. And it's important that when a brief comes, there's a lot of requests, especially the last 4 years, for us to design stuff. But almost always we say no, just because, first, we don't have time. Second, we want to make sure that what we do actually is inherently good for the brand.
Yeah.
So we don't do a lot of hero pieces, for lack of better description. We try to have breakthroughs in terms of what we're trying to do, but we want to make sure that it actually ultimately at the end, aside from breakthrough also, it needs to serve the purpose of the brand. Mm. To a certain extent, financially, it needs to be feasible for them.
Now, I'm sure it'll strike some people how thoughtful that you are about this process, including that process of working with more brands, winning new business, if you like. Do we sometimes risk, because of the intensity of the show schedule, this need for new constantly, and losing a bit of thoughtfulness and maybe losing a bit of humanity a bit of the kind of considerations you're talking about. Does that, it clearly worries you in terms of how you run your your office. Is that a bigger problem for the design industry?
Absolutely, and I think I'm nervous that it becomes another fashion industry where there's the pressure to always have new quality, new products, new style, you know, every fall season, and everyone's following everyone. And if we're not careful, the design world is going to fall in that category. The good thing is we're an interdisciplinary practice. So first and foremost, we're architects, both Rosanna and I. So not just architects, but we also do interior design. We also do master planning. We also teach. So all these come to play when we're actually thinking of design as a product. So the product is really not our main focus. It is one of many, and it is very much integrated into the projects we're working on. So many of the products you see that's launched here oftentimes stems from the projects that we are working, be it architecture and interior design.
Now that's interesting, because we've discussed with some other guests already this week a kind of a paradox at the heart of this, which is that for all the more narrative about the digital transformation and the growth in connectivity, people maybe seem more disconnected in a way.
Yes.
Do you agree with that paradox
to a certain extent? Yeah.
Why do we put up with it? Or do we put up with it? I sense that you don't accept
it. No, I certainly don't put up with it. It's funny because let's go back to the Renaissance period, right? People don't hire architects anymore nowadays to design products. It's only product designers. When in fact, if you look at, be it Gio Ponte, or let's even look at Le Corbusier, or let's look at Michelangelo, right? It's not just about the building itself. It's also how the interior is designed and how every piece is very much done in a holistic way. So it's very much connected, and I think that's what you were talking about. So we make an effort to make sure that when we get into a project that we actually design it from a not just an interdisciplinary point of view, but from a holistic point of view. And that goes the same with the digital world. I think it seems like we're so connected, and yet we're really not talking to each other. You know, we're more interested in the likes, the Instagram world that we are in, and people, you see in Milan nowadays, there's just so many posts out there. And in fact, people are saying that this particular year, there's not a destination, what they called an iconic destination that usually they have every year. You know, be it COS, was it 2 years ago, Studio Swine, I can't even remember now. There's always that iconic place that you go to. And apparently they're saying this year, there's none.
Oh no, what are we going to do with there's no iconography anymore?
And maybe it's actually good. Yeah. You see that people, it forces people to think. Rather than just go, let's line up for 2-3 hours to see Apple dropping or, you know, Sony coming up with the new technology so that we can photograph them and pose it and say, we have been to Milan. It's like going to a museum and not really interested in the show and beeline straight to the gallery shop and buy the monograph of the artist that's presenting and saying to yourself, oh yeah, I saw, you know, Ansel Keefer's show.
Did you have to be almost, I don't know what's the word, evangelical a little bit about your practice?
It's interesting you should use that word. Maybe that's also my background, you know. I was raised a Pentecostal, so I speak tongues and sometimes, no, to a certain extent. But then it can't be fake. It needs to come out of your heart. There needs to be a certain conviction. It was interesting because in Shanghai, we don't just have a practice. We also have a small furniture store in a former police station called Design Republic. Okay, and it was open in 2016. And it was funny because about last week, I was going through what we did. And the first time we were in Milan, or not the first time, when we actually seriously came here was, I believe, 2004.
Okay.
Yeah, that was 15 years ago.
A decade and a half.
But in 2005, we had this big poster that was all over Tortona. And Tortona was really a hotbed of creative design at that time. Not to say it's not now. But we had this poster that says Chairman Mao. 1977, a great leader died. 1980, the nation opens up, which is when China opened up to the world. 1990, two nations become one, Hong Kong and China. And 2006, the birth of a new republic, right? Which was our store, Design Republic. In many ways, at that time, we didn't really have a practice then, but we believed in bringing the best of what the world can bring to China, because China was known always as a place of copy. Yeah. And one day, hopefully, the best of China can be brought back to the world. Yeah. And so that was just a stupid, naive ambition of my part, from me and Rosanna, and so we kind of created this. And looking back, it's kind of interesting. 15 years later, we have our practice near Inhu, and obviously we also have a furniture retail store called Design Republic.
Yeah.
And we carry many of these brands, including some of the new Chinese brands that are now
exactly
in Milan.
Well, and I think, you know, naivety can be kind of liberating, maybe.
Yes.
In, for creative industries,
yes,
to a
yes
degree.
It, yes.
It's maybe a bit risky.
Yeah. There needs to be a balance, though.
Well, do you think we're a little risk-averse? Or if we look at the, not all creative industries, let's look at design maybe more specifically. There's a small C conservatism, which you can understand. Brands have a lot at stake and all the rest of it. Are we too risk-averse?
Yes, I think so. There's a tendency to go by the traditional route. Mm. So when someone opens a restaurant, when Tom Dixon's open a restaurant to showcase furniture, oftentimes people start going, why? Because what they don't understand, it's very hard. You know, there's always designation. Are you a buyer? Are you a designer? Are you a brand manufacturer? Are you a brand producer? I mean, we have so many specifications that we have no room for hybrids. Mm. And yet, as human beings, we're really not that specific. We can be many things. Mm. But I do believe the business world, the world of law, wants the design world to be confined in this little cubicle. So we will be paid as little as we can be, and they can take advantage of the things we do. All right? So if you look at major companies, be it car company, be it Google, be it Airbnb, design is important. But they don't really want to pay so much for design. They want to hire a designer, and immediately the first thing they do is hire in-house designer to copy the DNA of that first design that they've created. Mm-hmm. Right? And I think that's kind of sad. So as designers, I believe we've got to take the step and says, you know what, why don't we create our own brand? Why don't we have collaborations with the fashion brands, the car makers, the hospitality group, to start to change the conversation and not wait for, you know, the Boston Consulting of this world to say, let me just hire a bunch of designers, and they put in the suit and tie and then present it, and they get paid 90%, we get 10%. That's ridiculous.
But is that aspect of it is a false economy, though, isn't it? That's correct. Self-defeating, ultimately.
Correct.
Is it?
Okay. You mean
for those players to slightly, maybe cynically exploit.
Yeah, but that's happening quite a bit.
It is, yes, happening. In the end, that's doomed, isn't it, ultimately? Or not necessarily?
I don't
It'll
know.
Take a while.
I hope it does, right, and I hope it's... But that's actually a path that a lot of people are taking. And designers are so timid. We're taught to draw. We're taught to defend our projects. We're not taught to deal with money. We're not taught to deal with marketing. We're not taught to deal with management. In architecture school, interior design school, or product design school, it's all about product itself and how beautiful the things. And we are our own jargon. We love each other. We come to Milan. We hug each other. You know, I was in the dinner last night, and some of the top designers, and, you know, I know most of them, and it's great, you know, and it's great. It's a great reunion. But at the same time, it's also kind of dangerous because we're so happy. We pat each other's back. And then the big brands just laugh at us. I'm not talking about the furniture brand, because they're also taking advantage of. The business world and the world of, you know, the legal economy loves to have this whole fair, but they also like to control it so that design will be limited.
That was Shanghai-based Linda Neri speaking to Walthamstow-based Tom Edwards in Milan. And with regret, that's all the time we have on today's show. But next week...
The Shed was always conceived as a democratic, welcoming, and open place. It was meant to build new audiences.
We bring you an in-depth interview with New York-based architect Liz Diller to talk about her life, work, and, of course, her latest project, the multi-arts institution, The Shed. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnizes and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Vennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.